Hey guys, this is Cole Kublik from WJOX in Birmingham and the SEC Network, and you're listening to the AU Wishbone.
White Rocket Entertainment, podcast number 519.
You are listening to the AU Wishbone, almost credible sports discussion on the White Rocket Entertainment Network.
Bye-bye, Bo!
The kick is good! Auburn wins! Shivers just ran through a man! Touchdown, Auburn!
Hello and welcome to the AU Wishbone, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment, in association with TheWarEagleReader.com and all our great supporters via Patreon.com. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and John and I are taking the week off from doing a live show this week, so I thought instead I would post the full body of my interview several months ago with Cole Kublik. You all know Cole. He played on the offensive line for Auburn at the end of the Terry Bowden era and the beginning of the Tommy Tuberville era. And he has some really good insights about playing as a, you know, as a player during that era. And then he has gone on, of course, to work for ESPN, the SEC Network, and for WJOX, the radio station in Birmingham. And so he's pretty ubiquitous these days. He's all over Auburn football and SEC and national sports media talking about college football, talking about the SEC and about Auburn. And so I asked him, and he was gracious enough to sit down with me back in 2019, so probably a little over a year ago, to record some segments for the We Believe series that I've been posting occasionally over the last few months. There are two more episodes of that to go. So some parts of what you're about to hear, you may have encountered in bits and pieces here and there over the last year or two. Other parts, you have never been published, I don't believe, and certainly not all of this in one place with me asking him questions and everything. So without further ado, here comes Cole Kublik of WJOX and the SEC Network ESPN sitting down with me for about a half an hour to talk about Auburn football. What was it like having Terry Bowden as a coach, and how would you see him kind of as a coach overall? How did he fit in as an SEC coach?
Terry was cool as a head coach. He didn't try to go out of his way to get into your business and didn't try to make life miserable on many guys. I feel like he was a bit of a player's coach. There were times when maybe he felt, guys on the team felt like he was a little bit caught up with some of the other things that came with being a college coach and became a little bit disconnected from some of his players. But I think he was someone who understood what he wanted his team to be. He allowed his coaches to coach. He allowed his coordinators to coordinate, and he sort of managed that and managed it well. He wasn't an in your face kind of a guy. He wasn't a real rah rah guy. He wasn't somebody who cussed you out, but he was direct and he was blunt, and he let you know right away, hey, we need this from you. We need you to be this. We need you to be that, and we need you to improve here. And I think because he didn't try to go overboard with how he delivered his message, that it made it easier for a lot of guys to get on board with what he wanted to do. Overall, as a coach in the league, he had obvious success, and there were, the reasons that he got run, I don't think that too many of them had to do with his performance on the field. Did we have a bad year in 98? We did, but we were in the SEC championship game in 97 and lost our quarterback and lost our inside linebacker and lost our left tackle and lost our fullback. I mean, anybody with football common sense should have known that there was going to be a bit of a rebuild. So I'll always be appreciative to Terry Bowden for giving me a scholarship. And I think he's somebody who was a good head coach and knew how to be a good head coach, just got a little distracted.
Do you think that he is underrated today? I mean, he's almost become in some ways almost like a punchline to many people, even a lot of Auburn fans. I mean, is that unfair?
I think it is. I think it's easy. It's low-hanging fruit. People are going to talk about his height, and people are going to talk about the bloodline, and that's the only reason he got the job is because of his dad and because of his family and things of that nature. But again, I go back to just being a part of what he was trying to do and how he tried to build it, and it made a lot of sense. And he understood how to recruit. He understood how to utilize talent, and he understood how to deliver a message to a guy of, if you're not going to perform this way, or if you're not going to give us this, then you're not going to be a part of our team, or you're not going to play. And I feel like he organized his team fairly well and his coaching staff fairly well. And I think some of the ways that people do sort of talk about him and maybe unfairly label him for what he was is inaccurate. But listen, there were things that were going on that led to his dismissal. So you can't just completely overlook those things. And I think Terry would be fair and honest with you, and he would tell you that. So it's it's kind of one of those things that got in the way, and he got a little bit distracted. But there are a lot of things about him that I think he is unfairly labeled as, and I also don't think he gets enough credit for how good he was early on in his coaching tenure.
Talk a little bit about the 1997 SEC championship game. I remember that game fondly. I was there. I remember how hard it was for Auburn to get there, even including having to win that tough Iron Bowl that year with the fumble at the end with Sissom. And, I mean, did you guys expect to get to Atlanta that year? And did you expect to beat that Tennessee team with Manning? And how did it all sort of play out for the players?
I think going into the season, we did. The expectations were pretty high in-house, I mean, with us. I can remember Jimbo talking about, making it to the Orange Bowl that year. And that was kind of the goal. And that he, wanted to win our opener. And then wanted to win our opener against Virginia, wanted to win the SEC championship game, and then wanted to play for a national championship. Those were the goals. And I can remember Jimbo getting up in front of the offense and talking about those things earlier that year. But you think about the guys that we had. I mean, we had Victor Riley at left tackle. We had Fred Beasley at fullback. And we had a good group of receivers with Carson Bailey and Tyrone Goodson. And, and Eric Lowe. And I think going into that year with Damian Craig ready to have a breakout year, and Bill Oliver running the defense with Jimmy Brumbaugh and Charles Dorsey and Taquio Spikes and Ricky Neal, Martavius Houston, like we thought we were going to be pretty damn good, and for good reason, because we had legitimate players. I mean, we had guys who could play and were going to be the best at their position in the league. And if Damian, this was before the whole mobile quarterback thing really got going. So we were ready to add another dimension to our offense and felt like we were good enough around Damian that he wouldn't just have to do everything. And it just so happened we couldn't get the run game going for whatever reason. And I think if you look back on it now, a lot of people would have said, man, if we'd have just put Kevin McLeod at fullback and Fred Beasley at tailback and tried to pound it at people, we might have had some success, because we had a couple good offensive linemen on that team, and we should have had more success than we did. Now, Mississippi State was still a pretty good team. Florida was still a pretty. I think when we played Florida, it was like 3-6 or something when they came into Jordan-Hare Stadium. Mm-hmm. So it's not like they weren't a really good football team. And obviously Damian struggled against Mississippi State, but those Joe Lee Dunn defenses were just a nightmare to play against back then. You never knew what you were going to get, and they were tough. So I think we all expected to be there. And then when you watched them on film, they were a team that had some elite players, but they didn't do a whole lot. And so I think when you're not having to be overly concerned about scheme and doing different things, I mean, John Chavis was pretty bland that year. I mean, he ran a 4-3. And then he would slide down into an odd defense where he'd put his stand linebacker at the line of scrimmage. They play kind of a 5-2 look. And that was about all they did, because he had so many good players. Whether it was Leonard Little or, whether it was Al Wilson. And then they had guys on offense. I mean, they had Peyton Manning. And they had some good players on offense. And Jamal Lewis was just getting going. So you knew, like, guy for guy, yeah, they were probably a little bit more talented, but from a scheme wise, we felt pretty good about what Brother and those guys were going to do, and we thought Damian could have some success down the field. We just, at that point in the season, we weren't a very balanced offense, and I think that was a concern. But yeah, we thought we could win that football game, and going over to play in Georgia with the amount of Georgia guys that we had, that meant a lot to them to be able to go play in the SEC championship game. So we thought we had enough motivation and talent and scheme to be able to beat Tennessee that day. Just so happened they made some plays late and we didn't get it done.
Damian Craig in particular, where do you put him in the pantheon of Auburn quarterbacks?
Well, I'm going to say this. No matter where I put him, overall, he's underrated. Because I don't think people realize what kind of a competitor he was and what kind of a leader he was and the amount of things that he did on the practice film, in the facility, and on game day to make the offense, make the team better than maybe it really was. And, you know, you don't – some of that you don't understand until you get up next to him and you're just like, really? I mean, the guy's 6'1", 190 pounds, and, you know, could throw the ball 80-something yards in the air and obviously had good wheels, but he was a gamer. He didn't get good protection that year. He didn't have a run game to lean on that year, but, man, he just consistently made plays. And outside of a bad game or two, I think outside of Cam Newton and obviously outside of Pat, and outside of maybe Jason Campbell, he should be there at probably that tier two of best quarterbacks in Auburn football history. And I don't feel like he gets that due very much. He doesn't get a lot of that discussion, at least from what I hear. I mean, I just don't hear a lot of people that sort of put him in that conversation. And maybe that's because the tail end of his career was right when things got bad. And so a lot of people don't remember it. And obviously, there's a big part of Jason that was a bit of a resurrection of Auburn football. And, you know, he gets a ton of credit, but he was also a great player, and he deserves that credit. So I don't really know what it is, but it's almost like you hear more about Stan White and Pat Nix than you do Damian Craig. And that's – I mean, I'm not putting him over Cam. I'm not taking him over Pat Sullivan. And – I mean, for me personally, it would be really close with Jason Campbell, but I'd probably take Jason first based on his size and durability. But man, from a competitive standpoint and a leadership standpoint, it'd be hard. You can make a real strong argument that Damian should be next in line, to be honest with you.
What would Damian be like in like a Gus Malzahn offense, particularly like from 13, 14 in there?
Well, I don't know about the 13 offense if he would be great, because he's never going to be like an option guy. And we put in a speed option against Georgia in 97. We had a week off before that week, and we put in a bunch of single back stuff and ran zone, and he ran kind of like a little flat line speed option, and we wore him out because they didn't see any of that stuff coming. We had worked on it for a while. And then again, that kind of goes back to Terry, what kind of a coach he was. Nobody's ever going to talk about that kind of stuff. Nobody's ever going to talk about Terry going in and putting in a completely different offense against a really good Georgia team and then essentially kicking their ass. And that's what we did that year. And, you know, Damian wasn't going to be a guy that I don't think he could handle the contact of being a guy who ran the ball in between the tackles 10 or 12 times a game, or a guy who had deliberate quarterback runs, you know, 15, 17 times a game. But I mean, if you gave him the option of being able to keep the ball and then, you know, he knew how to protect himself like a Kyler Murray does, I mean, he probably could eat you up, and because he had good enough wheels to be able to break the defense down. And, you know, I mean, some of the stuff he got away with was just like bootlegs. I mean, legitimate just play action with a hard bootleg rollout, and the design was for him to keep the ball, or just sprint out passes where it was designed where he could keep the ball. And it didn't give him running the football a very high rate of success, but a lot of times he found ways to make that successful. And I think more times than not, what you're looking at is either like a smoke draw where, you know, you knew he was going to show pass and then get north and south, or when he left the pocket, you know, he was somebody who could really do damage there. And the most critical part about that was Damian kept his eyes downfield, and he was very accurate on the run. And he could still throw a really nice deep ball on the run. And that's where he just absolutely torched some teams, is when he would leave the pocket and keep his eyes down the field and then take a chance deep, and he could really get it over the top of a defense when that happened.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember that Georgia game from 97. I believe that was the DeMontre Carter running all over the place?
Yep.
Yeah, I told my co-host of the day, I said, I can't tell you what I had for dinner yesterday, but I remember DeMontre Carter having that one great game against Georgia in 1997. So it's funny how things stick in your memory. I was there. I remember that very clearly. Yeah, it was a completely different offense, and Georgia didn't have a clue what was going on. That was amazing.
No, they were lost, and that was I think that was a top 10 Georgia team when we played them.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're talking about that was an awesome game plan, and it was an awesome game. Because that Georgia team, they had some studs on that football team.
Their fans in the stands around me were shocked. They were absolutely stunned. They couldn't believe it, what they were seeing.
I wonder what they thought in 99.
Yeah, even better in a way. Yeah, that was amazing too. I used to live in Lawrenceville, so I would make the nice little drive right up the road to Athens for the Georgia game, for the Auburn-Georgia game. That was my easiest. It was easier than to get to Auburn, you know. So I got to see all those 90s, early 2000s games in Georgia, and those were mostly great. We did
that Georgia
very
team
well.
Was number 7 when we played them.
Wow.
You think about, like I mentioned, the teams we lost to, like Florida was ranked 7th, Tennessee was ranked 3rd.
Yep.
You know, Mississippi State wasn't ranked, but they were just, man, they were a tough team. That was a physical football team. So, you know, beat number 10 LSU on the road that year. That was, you know, Damian led that drive.
Yeah, at the end.
To help us win that game late. I mean, it could have been a better year, but it was still it was a really good season.
It really was. It really was. So let's flip over now and look at Tubbs, Coach Tuberville. Same kind of thing. So how would you describe Tommy Tuberville and what it was like to play for him?
It was fun to play for Tuberville. He was definitely a player's coach. You know, when I got to be a senior under Tuberville, and he gave the seniors a lot of say, a lot of power on the football team. He let us make a lot of decisions. We had senior meetings with the head coach every week, and we got to voice our opinions on anything that we thought was going wrong, going right, what we wanted to change. He was that kind of a coach, and he was kind of the ultimate CEO coach, and that type coach has become a bit prehistoric in today's college football, but when he was doing it, I think there was part of it that you almost had to be that because you didn't have as many media outlets. So a lot of times I think a coach had to seek out ways to promote their team, and Tubbs could do that and knew how to do that. He was a good motivator. I think he understood when to step in and try to push guys, when to lay off guys. He didn't interfere with his coordinators very much. He was very organized. He was very deliberate, and he was just fun. You know, he had a very loose atmosphere, a very light atmosphere. You knew when it was time to take care of your business, but at the same time, I think it also helped make it fun a lot of times when maybe under the previous regime, it wasn't very much fun. Now, some of that's position coach based, but you know, Tubb did a good job of making things fun that weren't always meant to be fun.
That's interesting. That is, huh? So, where does he fit in the pantheon of SEC head coaches? I mean, I feel like. And especially in terms of Auburn people, I feel like Auburn fans think very highly of him. And you know, even though things ended kind of weird, they always do. When you lose a coach after a number of years, there's always some weird season, you know, that you kind of – it kind of is the final nail in the coffin. But I feel like Auburn fans really look back very fondly on Tuberville and have almost nothing bad to say about him. And I think most Auburn fans really blame the ending of his tenure more on Nick Saban's arrival and maybe some problems with assistants and really don't put hardly any blame on him. And it's kind of the same way with Pat Dye. Is that the sense you have?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, I think Tubbs, I think the way that he left almost now helps him a little bit because I think a lot of people look at what was happening behind the scenes and feel like Tubbs got a bit of a raw deal. And wasn't necessarily treated fairly, that he should have had a couple more opportunities to see if he could get things going again the way that he had in the past. I don't know many coaches that could have done what he did as fast as he did it when he took over. And he probably doesn't get enough credit for that, as how bad a shape that thing was in when they did arrive. And I'll go to my grave telling people that first off season – that took years off of our lives. It really did. I mean, you ask Alex Lincoln, you ask Ben Leard, you ask Rob Pate, you ask Kendall Simmons, you know, you ask those guys about that offseason, and they'll tell you the same thing, that it was ridiculously hard. But he got us to the SEC championship game the following year when we were picked last in the division to go in going into the season. Mm-hmm. And I think that probably taught him the lesson that your seniors and your upperclassmen are going to be very important in what you do. And he kept that alive throughout his coaching tenure. And obviously we all know what 2004 was, and he had a couple of other good years. And I think there were just a couple of odd games and years that unfortunately people may be allowed to stick in their mind a little bit too much. But he did a lot of great things for Auburn. I do think that he should be mentioned as one of the best coaches in Auburn football history based on the things that he accomplished. And who knows what would have happened if somebody else came in when he did, how much longer things would have been down. Just look at his success against Alabama, number one. Mm-hmm. And then to win an SEC championship, to get Auburn to multiple SEC championship games. Mm-hmm. And that to me shows you what kind of a coach that he was. So I'm appreciative of him. He and I still keep in touch, and I consider him a friend. Mm-hmm. And I think he did a lot for Auburn football. And if you're talking about things that he did that probably don't get talked about, that won't be remembered, the first thing that I would say is turning it around after the Bowden era. Because when you fire, people don't realize when you fire a coach mid-season, a lot of the players check out. Yeah, but a lot of the coaches check out too. And that means they're not recruiting. And that means they're not doing their things to help develop the players. You're not spending as much time on the practice field, in the film room. So it gets set back so much more than I believe the average fan understands. And Tommy and Noel Mazzoni and Eddie Grant and Don Dunn and Terry Price, they came in and turned that thing around. And that's why a lot of those guys are still coaching and still having a lot of success in coaching, because they knew what they were doing. And they were loyal to Tommy. And he allowed them to do most of the things his way, but a lot of his way worked. And that's why he had the success that he did.
And, you know, as successful as he was, it's amazing that in like 2005 and 2006, you could point to like one play in one game of each of those years as keeping Auburn from going to another SEC championship game in each of those years. It was so close.
That's kind of what I referenced earlier, that it's unfortunate that you have a couple of plays, a handful of games, in a season or two that really probably don't allow Tuberville to be remembered the way that he should for a lot of Auburn fans. And I'm not sitting here, you know, trying to jump on some high horse saying Tommy Tuberville is the best guy to ever coach at Auburn. I'm not saying that. But my point is that Tommy Tuberville did a lot of really good things for Auburn and brought Auburn back from a pretty dark place and helped Auburn achieve some things that they hadn't achieved in a very long time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and the last thing I had planned to ask you, and then if there's anything else you want to throw in, is that 2000 season. We talked about 1997 as a big season when you were there with Terry. You were also there in 2000. And you know, after 98 was not very good, 99 was one of those years where you still end up 5-6, but it was, there were some that were so close, we were close to breaking through, even like you say, with reduced talent and trying to get everything turned back around. 2000 was very much of a season where you kind of go, yes, now we're going in the right direction again. So, you know, you had Rudy Johnson come in and just be the man at running back, and the obviously the offensive line, as you can speak to, was playing really well. The defense playing well and everything. Talk a little bit about that 2000 season, and did you guys see that coming? Did you expect it, or was it kind of a surprise, or what?
I think we kind of knew. We knew what we had, and then when Rudy showed up in the spring, we were kind of like, oh. This could kind of really change things, because I think you knew that we had, you know, you had me and Colin Sears and Hart McGarry and Kendall Simmons and Mike Pasillo and Ben Nallen was on that team. So we had a lot of guys up front that were going to be able to help open up some holes. And even without Rudy Johnson, we had Heath Evans, who at times operated as a tailback in 98 and looked pretty good. And then the same thing in 99, you know, he was going to be a guy that could probably help us a little bit. You had a couple of young kids that were coming in, like Roger Hood, Tavarius Robinson. You know, and we, you know, you kind of looked at some of the young guys and you're like, Reggie Torbor, all right, if these guys can help us a little bit, you know, we might be able to sort of get over the hump. And we had a lot of leadership on that football team. Obviously, Ben Lear's a senior at quarterback, a guy that almost got run out of town in 1998 and then really had a chip on his shoulder and had a lot to prove. Alex Lincoln on defense, who was a walk-on. Nobody respected him when he showed up, worked his ass off, and became a really good college football player. And without a neck injury, I think would have played a couple years in the NFL and could have been a successful NFL player. I think DeMarco McNeil was one of those younger guys that got thrown in and helped us out a little bit. Rob Pate was in the secondary and had played a ton of football and just essentially was a coach on the field. We just had a lot of those kind of guys that football meant a lot to us. We had a lot to prove. We had been through a lot. I mean, we had been through hell and just wanted to make things positive. Like, just wanted to find a way to leave with some positive things, and those positive things have our names on them. And I think that's what you get when you get a lot of guys who have been around. You don't have to go out of your way to coach them or teach them or explain things to them. And that allows you to do different things and change things and be different at certain times across the course of a season. And it allows you to have, obviously, leadership without having to force it into play. And so I think having those kind of guys, and then you insert a Rudy Johnson, who became just a stud running back, a complete bowling ball, with, you know, guys like Lorenzo Diamond and Robert Johnson at tight end and Clifton Robinson out at wide receiver, and Reggie Worthy was one of those guys that had been around us for a long time. You had guys that just knew what their job was. I mean, it was kind of New England Patriots, like, you know, just do your job. And everybody was pretty good at doing that. Nobody was, you know, I mean, Rudy was the only real elite talent that I think we had on that team, as far as, you know, was just dominant at times. But you had so many other guys that understood not only how to do their job, but help other people be better at theirs. And we had a pretty good coaching staff. I mean, you know, Eddie Grand's he's the offensive coordinator at Kentucky. He's been up for some head coaching jobs. Noel Mazzoni's the offensive coordinator out of Arizona. He had success almost everywhere else he's been. You know, Terry Price is coaching at Texas A&M. So a lot of those guys are still coaching for a reason, because they were good. You know, Dan Werner was part of that staff. He's at South Carolina coaching quarterbacks. So we had a lot of good people around us that knew football and knew how to help make us better at football. And, you know, it's a pretty cool year. I think it's one that I'm not saying that Auburn fans should, you know, put us on top of any list of the best teams in history, but it was a pretty cool season, mainly because of what the expectations were and what I know it meant to everybody in that locker room, especially the upperclassmen. I mean, to be able to go back to Bryant Denny for the first time in, I don't know, 100 years.
Yes.
And win there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for Ben Lear to beat Georgia as a senior quarterback at home, I mean, in his second consecutive year, he beat them as a starter, and have guys like Antoine Nolan that played at Georgia. And, you know, the year before we beat them in 99 the way we did, you know, that was kind of building up to 2000. And then, you know, we knew what we wanted to be, and we found ways to get it done.
One of the things that occurs to me talking about those years, you got to go up against Steve Spurrier some, and, you know, he's kind of taken on that patina of one of those great, you know, it's like his stature kind of was on its way down a little bit toward the end of his career there, but it's kind of in the rearview mirror, I think, come back up again. What was it like to have to go up against that Florida team that was so different from really what the SEC had seen before that? And what are your memories about Spurrier back then?
Yeah, I would like to forget most of those because they did not go very well. And thankfully, after I left, they had some success against Florida. So that, you know, that gave Auburn fans a little bit of hope that he wasn't going to be completely indestructible. But, you know, 96, I didn't travel, but, you know, my teammates went down there, and that thing was ugly. And then, of course, they get us in 97, and I think that was what I just said a few minutes ago, the number 7 team in the country, something like that. And, or no, Georgia was 7, Florida was like 3. They came into Jordan-Hare and beat us. And then, of course, we go down to the Swamp. And the cool part about, you know, 2000 was we lost to Mississippi State and Florida in the regular season in 97 and went to the championship game. And I can remember we lost to Mississippi State in 2000. We lost to Florida. And I kind of stood up in front of the team in the locker room after that Florida game, and I was like, hey, 1997, a lot of you guys weren't here. We lost to these same two teams, and we ended up in Atlanta. This is over. It happened. There's no reason we can't go do this again. The same two teams. There's no reason we can't go do this again. We got a lot in front of us. Let's make this happen. And I remember Noel Mazzone came over and he was like, shit, man, nobody on this coaching staff would have thought to say that. So he's like, I appreciate you sharing that. And it's a great point. And we got to go figure out how to get better and we can still make this happen. So he was a guy, you know, then the SEC championship game in 2000 and that thing was just ugly. They just had so much talent. Like, people don't even remember Gerard Warren. Gerard Warren was a nose guard that I had to go up against every play in the SEC championship game. That dude was the number three overall pick. You know, people don't even talk about him. Mm-hmm. But Marquand Manuel and Jacques Green and Rex Grossman, I mean, they were loaded. They were just loaded every year. And guys who could run, guys who were athletic, guys you couldn't block. You know, I remember 99, they came to Jordan-Hare. It was like an 8 o'clock ESPN kick. It was so weird because they didn't have those late games yet. And, you know, they had Alex Brown at defensive end. And he was like the next guy after Javon Kearse, like their next elite pass rusher. And he had like 8 sacks against Tennessee earlier in the year. And so we were going to set our protection to Alex Brown and take him out of the game. And so we're sliding the protection. We're putting a tight end over there. We're sending a running back his way. And come to find out, we didn't figure it out until like the fourth quarter when it was 38 to nothing and Jeff Klein was in the game, that they were essentially zone blitzing him and dropping him on every play. And we were just wasting our protection, and that's how they were finding a way to get to the quarterback. So, you know, he had good defenses too. People forget that. And he had good running backs and a good running game and some good offensive linemen. You know, it wasn't just Danny Werfel and Chris Doering and Rydell Anthony and Ike Hilliard. I mean, they had dudes all over the place. But I'll never forget after the 2000 SEC championship game, because he was friends with Bill Oliver, and they had a great relationship. And I think you know, through Bill, he kind of learned my story. And we played down there. And that game in 2000, when I played down in the Swamp, and I came in for Ben Nallen, that's kind of when I started sort of reasserting myself back into the lineup. And, you know, he kind of sought me out after that SEC championship game, which was my second start of the year. I started the Iron Bowl, the SEC championship game, and the Citrus Bowl and of my senior year, which was one of the hardest things I've ever been through. And he, you know, he kind of found me. He goes, hey, man, I just want you to know, I know your story. I know what you've been through. And you know, I respect what you've done. And I'm just thinking, like, what? Steve Spurrier just out of nowhere comes and tells me that after that game. So
wow, it's
pretty cool moment for him to do that, and just kind of shows you, outside of the trash talking and outside of the, you know, the what, how good of a coach he is and the sly comments, that he's a pretty good dude at the same time.
Yeah, that's great. That's really good. What do you think is the future of Auburn football? Where does the program need to go? What do they need to do that they're not doing now if you were the athletic director or something like that? Any thoughts along those lines?
The development of players has to change, has to get better, has to improve. There seems to be too many guys over the last 4 or 5 years that come in as A and leave as somewhere in between A and B, as opposed to X, Y, or Z, as far as player development is concerned. And if I were to give you one word that has to happen in the future for Auburn football to continue to be great, it would be consistency.
Yeah.
And I think they're, and I don't know how to tell Alan Green how to do that. They sat me down and said, we're going to pay you $1 million a year. Come in and fix Auburn football. And I'd say the first thing we got to do is be more consistent. Well, how do we do that? Well, I'd need a lot of people helping me find the answer to that, because I'm not smart enough to figure it out on my own. But consistency in effort, consistency in execution, consistency in game planning, consistency in development of players. And I'm not saying all those things are inconsistent all the time, because they're not. But I know that they need to be consistent more often. And if that happens, then I think there are some good years in the near future for Auburn football. You feel like, okay, if things do become more consistent and they can find a way to erase some of the mistakes and a couple of more guys can develop maybe at a faster rate than the previous guys have, they could be pretty good the next few years. But the one thing that I would say is finding a way top to bottom for players, coaches, performance, game plan, recruiting, development, all to become a little bit more consistent, I think would be what will determine just how good Auburn football can and will be the next 6 to 8 years.
Many, many thanks to Cole for coming on board and doing that. We really appreciate it. All right, John and I will be back next week with a regularly scheduled program. But in the meantime, of course, we have to thank the folks that make this program possible. For as little as $1 a month, you can join their ranks. Just go to www.auwishbone.com and click on the big orange button to become a patron. Here are the folks currently doing that very thing. They include Chris and Clinton Stewart, Carl Von Drunker, Bart Lindsay, Bradley Blackman, Chris Usher, Gary Grant, Logan Chilton, Phil Amthor, Richard Stevens, Steve Trawick, Susan Trawick, Tom Anderson, Willie Carden, Ann Kangian, AU Falling Up, Ben Bloodworth, Clay Henson, Dan Thompson, Daniel Odom, David Evers, David Hegler, Emmanuel Seaman, George Gaston, Jacob and Robin Fleming, James Greenwell, Joel Beckham, John Otsuki, Catherine England, Kevin Smith, Mickey B, Phil Davis, Preston Settle, Reynolds Wolf, Rich Reimer, Steve Harlan, Timothy WDE Ritchie, Wes Atkinson, William Morgan, Wilson Beard, Winston Boddy, Alex Nguyen, Blake Heron, Boris the Tiger, Cato the Barner, Chris the Hilton, Chris Thrash, Colby Butler, Danny Flack, as well as Darius Benton, David Simpson, Die Bama, not a moment too soon, Earl Ricks, Eric Mahan, Hugh Anderson, Josh Teal, Kevin Kenoy, Kevin Mahan, Lane Middleton, Melissa Blackstone, Mike Finley, Algorithm, Papa Todd, Patrick Williams, Randall Walker, Rob Morgan, Ross, Russell Milling, Shannon Butson, Sarah Hines, Sasquatch, Shane Bailey, Snowdog, Stephen Houston, Tim Pittman, Tony Perry, Auburn Elvis, Ben Amos, Brandon Sisson, Brandon Smith, Chris Como, Darren Pyle, David Smiley, Donnie Reynolds, James Taylor, Jason the Weasel Skull Albrecht, John Stubbs, John Zavachin, Joey Miller, Joseph Iliff, Justin Bean, Lawrence Kane, Mark Squire, Matthew Flowers, Mick Vijakana, Nicholas Craig, Paul Bankson, Robert Drain, Robert O. Salmons, and finally Russell Souther, Ruth and Darren Sutherland, Spanky, Stephen Thompson, Trevor Johnson, Kenneth Brent Rains, Brant Rumble, Chris, plus our one-time and anonymous donors. We thank you all. Go to www.auwishbone.com. All right, that's going to do it for this week. If John were here, I'm sure he would say War Eagle to you, but our time is up. We thank you for yours, so War Eagle, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the AU Wishbone. Find links to everything we do at www.auwishbone.com. For more Auburn fun, join us on Twitter at @AUWishbone and at facebook.com/AUWishbone. War Eagle.
The AU Wishbone is produced by Van Allen Plexico and John Ringer. Copyright 2020.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.
Thank you for listening to the AU Wishbone podcast.